The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the January 22, 1996 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Falls by George Saunders. Morse found it nerve-wracking to cross the St. Jude grounds just as the school was being dismissed, because he felt that if he smiled at the uniformed Catholic children, they might think he was a wacko or pervert, and if he didn't smile, they might think he was an old grouch made bitter by the world, which surely, he felt, by certain yardsticks, he was. Sometimes he wasn't entirely sure that he wasn't even a wacko of sorts, although certainly he wasn't a pervert. Of that he was certain, or relatively certain. Being overly certain, he was relatively sure, was what eventually made one a wacko. So humility was the thing, he thought, arranging his face into what he thought would pass for the expression of a man thinking fondly of his own youth, a face devoid of wackiness or perversion. Humility was the thing. The school sat among maples on a hillside that sloped down to the wide Taganak River, which narrowed and picked up speed and crashed over Bryce Falls, a mile downstream near Morse's small rental house. His embarrassingly small rental house, actually, which nevertheless was the best he could do and for which he knew he should be grateful, although at times he wasn't a bit grateful and wondered where he'd gone wrong. Although at other times he was quite pleased with the crooked little blue shack covered with peeling lead paint and felt great pity for the poor stiffs renting hazardous dumps even smaller than his hazardous dump, which was how he felt now as he came down into the bright sunlight and continued his pleasant walk home along the Green River, lined with expensive mansions whose owners he deeply resented. Morse was tall and thin and as gray and sepulchral as a church about to be condemned. His pants were too short, and his face periodically broke into a tense, involuntary grin that quickly receded, as if he had just suffered a sharp pain. At work, he was known to punctuate his conversations with brief, wild laughs and gusts of inchoate enthusiasm and subsequent embarrassment, expressed by a sudden plunging of his hands into his pocket, after which he would yank his hands out of his pockets, too ashamed of his own shame to stand there merely grimacing for even an instant longer. From behind him on the path came a series of arrhythmic, whacking steps. He glanced back to find Aldo Cummings, an odd duck who, though nearly 40, still lived with his mother. Cummings didn't work and had his bangs cut straight across and wore gym shorts even in the dead of winter. Morse hoped Cummings wouldn't collar him. When Cummings didn't collar him, and in fact passed by without even returning his nervous, self-effacing grin, Morse felt guilty for having suspected Cummings of wanting to collar him, and then miffed that Cummings, who collared even the City Hall cleaning staff, hadn't tried to collar him. Had he done something to offend Cummings? It worried him that Cummings might not like him, and it worried him that he was worried about whether a nut like Cummings liked him. Was he some kind of worry wart? It worried him. Why should he be worried when all he was doing was going home to enjoy his beautiful children without a care in the world, although on the other hand there was Robert's piano recital, which was sure to be a disaster, since Robert never practiced and they had no piano and weren't even sure where or when the recital was. And Annie, God bless her, had eaten the cardboard keyboard he'd made for Robert to practice on. When he got home, he would make Robert a new cardboard keyboard and beg him to practice. He might even order him to practice. He might even order him to make his own cardboard keyboard, then practice. Although this was unlikely, because when he became forceful with Robert, Robert blubbered, and Morse loved Robert so much he couldn't stand to see him blubbering. Although if he didn't become forceful with Robert, Robert tended to lie on his bed with his baseball glove over his face. Good God! But life could be less than easy. Not that he was unaware that it could certainly be a lot worse, but to go about it in such a state, pulse high, face red, worried sick that someone would notice how nervous one was certainly less than ideal. And he felt sure that his body was secreting all kinds of harmful chemicals, and that the more he worried about the harmful chemicals, the faster they were pouring out of wherever it was they came from. When he got home, he would sit on the steps and enjoy a few minutes of centered breathing while reciting his mantra, which was, "Calm down, calm down," before the kids came running out and grabbed his legs and sometimes even bit him quite hard in their excitement. And Ruth came out to remind him in an angry tone that he wasn't the only one who'd worked all day. And as he walked, he gazed out at the beautiful Taganak in an effort to absorb something of her serenity, but instead found himself obsessing about the faulty latch on the gate, which theoretically could allow Annie to toddle out of the yard and into the river. And he pictured himself weeping on the shore, and to eradicate this thought, started manically whistling "The Stars and Stripes Forever" while slapping his hands against his sides. Cummings bobbed past the restored gristmill, pleased at having so decisively snubbed Morse, a smug member of the power elite in the conspiratorial village, one of the League of Oppressive Oppressors who wouldn't know the lot of the struggling artist if the lot of the struggling artist came up with great and beleaguered dignity and bit him on the polyester rear end. Over the Pine Street Bridge was a fat cloud. To an interviewer in his head, Cummings said he felt the possible rain made the fine, bright day even finer and brighter because of the possibility of its loss. The possibility of its ephemeral loss. The ephemeral loss of the day to the fleeting passages of time. Preening time. Preening nascent time, the blackguard. Time made wastrels of us all, did it not? With its gaunt cheeks and its tombly reverberations and its admonishing glances with bony fingers. Bony fingers pointed as if in admonishment, as if to say, "I admonish you to recall your own eventual nascent death, which being on its way is forthcoming. Forthcoming, mortal coil, and don't think its ghastly paw won't settle on your furrowed brow. Pronto! Once I select your fated number from my very dusty book with the self-same bony finger with which I'm pointing at you now, you vanity of vanities, you luster, you shirker of duties as you shuffle after your worldly pleasure centers." That was some good stuff. If only he could remember it through the rest of his stroll and the coming storm to scrawl in a passionate hand in his yellow pad. He thought with longing ardor of his blank yellow pad, he thought. He thought with longing ardor of his blank yellow pad on which this self-same day his fame would be wrought. No, on which this self-same day the first meager scrawlings which would presage his nascent burgeoning fame would be wrought. Or rather writ. And someday someone would dig up his yellow pad and virtually cry, "Eureka!" when they realize what a teeming fragment of minutiae and yet crucial minutiae had been found, and wouldn't all kinds of literary women in short black jackets want to meet him then? In the future, he must always remember to bring his pad everywhere. The town had spent a mint on the riverfront, and now the burbling, smashing Taganat ran past a nail salon in a restored gristmill and a cafe in a former coal tower and a quaint public square where some high school boys with odd haircuts were trying to kick a soccer ball into the partly open window of a parked Colt with a joy so belligerent and obnoxious that it seemed they believed themselves the first boys ever to walk the face of the earth, which Morse found worrisome. What if Annie grew up and brought one of these freaks home? Not one of these exact freaks, of course, since they were approximately 15 years her senior, although it was possible that at 20 she could bring home one of these exact freaks, who would then be approximately 35, albeit over Morse's dead body, Although in his heart he knew he wouldn't make a stink about it, even if she did bring home one of the freaky snots who had just succeeded in kicking the ball into the colt and were now jumping around, joyfully bumping their bare chests together while grunting like walruses. And in fact, he knew perfectly well that rather than expel the 35-year-old freak from his home, he would likely offer him coffee or a soft drink in an attempt to dissuade him from corrupting Annie, who for God's sake was just a baby, because Morse knew very well the kind of man he was at heart. Timid of conflict, conciliatory to a fault, pathetically gullible, and with a pang he remembered Lynn Beck, who senior year had tricked him into painting his ass blue. If there had actually been a secret Blue Assers Club, if the ass painting had in fact been required for membership, it would have been bad enough. But to find out on the eve of one's prom that one had painted one's ass blue simply for the amusement of a clique of unfeeling swimmers who subsequently supplied certain photographs to one's prom date, that was too much. And he had been glad, quite glad, actually, at least at first, when Beck, drunk, had tried and failed to swim to Foley's Snag and been swept over the falls in the dark of night. The great tragedy of their senior year, a tragedy that had mercifully eclipsed Morse's blue ass in the class's collective memory. Two red-headed girls sailed by in a green canoe, drifting with the current. They yelled something to him, and he waved. Had they yelled something insulting? Well, certainly it was possible. Certainly today's children had no respect for authority. Although one had to admit there was always Ben Akbar, their neighbor, a little Pakistani genius who sometimes made Morse look askance at Robert. Ben was an all-state cellist on the wrestling team who was unfailingly sweet to smaller kids and toll-painted and could do a one-handed push-up. Ah, Ben Schmin, Morse thought. 10 Bens weren't worth a single Robert, although he couldn't think of one area in which Robert was superior or even equal to Ben, the little smarty pants. Although certainly he had nothing against Ben, Ben being a mere boy. But if Ben thought for a minute that his being more accomplished and friendly and talented than Robert somehow entitled him to lord it over Robert, Ben had another thing coming. Not that Ben had ever actually lorded it over Robert. On the contrary, Robert often lorded it over Ben, or tried to, although he always failed, because Ben was too sharp to be taken in by a little con man like Robert. And Morse's face reddened at the realization that he had just characterized his own son as a con man. Boy, oh boy, could life be a torture? Could life ever force a fellow into a strange, dark place from which he found himself doing graceless, unforgivable things like casting aspersions on his beloved firstborn? If only he could escape Blascorp and do something significant, such as discovering a critical vaccine. But it was too late. And he had never been good at biology, and in fact had flunked it twice. But some kind of moment in the sun would certainly not be unwelcome. If only he could be a tortured prisoner of war, who not only refused to talk, but led the other prisoners in rousing hymns at great personal risk. If only he could witness an actual miracle, or save the president from an assassin, or win the lotto and give it all to charity. If only he could be part of some great historical event, like the codgers he saw on PBS who had been slugged in the Haymarket riot, or known Medgar Evers, or lost beatific mothers on the Titanic. His childhood dreams had been so bright. He had hoped for so much. It couldn't be true that he was a nobody. Although, on the other hand, what kind of somebody spends the best years of his life swearing at a photocopier? Not that he was complaining. Not that he was unaware he had plenty to be thankful for. He loved his children. He loved the way Ruth looked in bed by candlelight when he had wedged the laundry basket against the door that wouldn't shut because the house was settling alarmingly. Loved the face she made when he entered her. Loved the way she made light of the blue ass story. Although he didn't particularly love the way she sometimes trotted it out when they were fighting. For example, on the dreadful night when the piano had been repossessed. Or the way she blamed his passivity for their poverty within earshot of the kids. Or the fact that at the height of her infatuation with Robert's karate instructor, Master Lee, she had been dragging Robert to class as often as 6 times a week. The poor little exhausted guy. But the point was, in spite of certain difficulties, he truly loved Ruth. So what if their bodies were failing and fattening and they undressed in the dark and Robert admired strapping athletes on television while looking askance at Morse's rounded, pimpled back? It didn't matter, because someday, when Robert had a rounded, pimpled back of his own, he would appreciate his father, who had subjugated his petty personal desires for the good of his family. Although, God willing, Robert would have a decent career by then and could afford to join a gym and see a dermatologist. And Morse stopped in his tracks, wondering what in the world two little girls were doing alone in a canoe speeding toward the falls, apparently oarless. Cummings walked along, gazing into a mythic, dusky, arboreal wood that put him in mind of the archetypal vision he had numbered 114 in his book of archetypal visions, on which Mom, that nitwit, had recently spilled grape pop. Vision 114 concerned standing on the edge of an ancient, dense wood at twilight, with the safe harbor of one's abode behind, and the deep wild ahead, replete with dark, fearsome bears looming from albeit dingy covents. What would that twitching, nervous wage slave Morse think if he were to dip his dim brow into the heady brew that was the archetypal visions? Morse. Ha! Cummings thought. I'm glad I'm not Morse, a dullard in corporate pants, trudging home to his threadbare brats in the gathering loam, born, like the rest of his ilk, with their feet of clay thrust down the maw of conventionality, content to cheerfully work lemming-like in moribund cubicles while comparing their stocks and bonds between bouts of tedious lawn mowing, and then chortling while holding their suckling brats to the Nintendo breast. That was a powerful image, Cummings thought. One that he might develop some brooding night into a Herculean prome that some Hollywood smoothie would eat like a hotcake. So he could buy Mom a Lexus and go with someone leggy and blousy to Paris after taking some time to build up his body with arm curls so as to captivate her physically as well as mentally. And in Paris, the leggy girl, in perhaps tight leather pants, would sit on an old-time bed with a beautiful shawl or blanket around her shoulders and gaze at him with doe eyes as he stood on the balcony brooding about the Parisian rain and so forth. And wouldn't Morse and his ilk stew and considerable juice when he sent home a postcard just to be nice? And wouldn't the village fall before him on repentant knees when T-shirts imprinted with his hard-won visage, his heraldic leonine visage, one might say, were available to all at the Five and Dime, and he held court on the porch in a white Whitman-esque suit while Mom hovered behind him getting everything wrong about his work and proffering inane snacks to his manifold admirers? And wouldn't revenge be sweet when such former football players as Ned Wentz began begging him for lessons in the sonnet? And all that was required for these things to come to pass was some paper and pens and a chaotic, blathering talent, the likes of which would not be seen again soon. the critics would write. All of which he had in spades, and he rounded the last bend before the falls, euphoric with his own possibilities, and saw a canoe the color of summer leaves ram the steep upstream wall of the snag. The girls inside were thrown forward and shrieked with open mouths over frothing waves that would not let them be heard as the boat split open along some kind of seam and began taking on water in doomful, fast quantities. Cummings stood stunned, his body electrified, hair standing up on the back of his craning neck, thinking, I must do something. Their faces are bloody, but what? Such fast, cold water. Still, I must do something. And he stumbled over the berm, uncertainly, looking for help, but finding only a farm field of tall, dry corn. Morse began to run. In all probability, this was silly. In all probability, the girls were safe on shore, or, if not, help was already on its way. Although certainly it was possible that the girls were not safe on shore, and help was not on its way. And in fact, it was even possible that the help that was on its way was him, which was worrisome because he had never been good under pressure, and in a crisis often stood mentally debating possible options with his mouth hanging open. Come to think of it, it was possible, even probable, that the boat had already gone over the falls or hit the snag. He remembered the crew of the barge Fat Chance, rescued via rope bridge in the early Carter years. He hoped several sweaty, decisive men were already on the scene and that one of them would send him off to make a phone call. Although, what if on the way he forgot the phone number and had to go back and ask the sweaty, decisive man to repeat it? And what if this failure got back to Ruth and she was filled with shame and divorced him and forbade him to see the kids? Who didn't want to see him anyway because he was such a panicky screw-up? This was certainly not positive thinking. This was certainly an example of predestining failure via negativity. Because, who could tell? Maybe he would stand in line assisting the decisive men and incur a nasty rope burn and go home a hero wearing a bandage, which might cause Ruth to regard him in a more favorable sexual light. And they would stay up all night celebrating his new manhood and exchanging sweet words between bouts of energetic lovemaking. Although, what kind of thing was that to be thinking at a time like this with children's lives at stake? He was bad, that was for sure. There wasn't an earnest bone in his body. Other people were simpler and looked at the world with clearer eyes. But he was self-absorbed and insincere, and mucked everything up. And he hoped this wasn't one more thing he was destined to muck up, because mucking up a rescue was altogether different from forgetting to mail out the invitations to your son's birthday party, which he had recently done. Although certainly they had spent a small fortune rectifying the situation, stopping just short of putting an actual pony on Visa. But the point was, this was serious, and he had to bear down. And throwing his thin legs out ahead of him, awkwardly bent at the waist, shirt tails trailing behind and bum knee hurting, he remonstrated with himself to put aside all self-doubt and negativity and prepare to assist the decisive men in whatever way he could once he had rounded the bend and assessed the situation. But when he rounded the bend and assessed the situation, he found no rope bridge or decisive men, only a canoe coming apart at the base of the snag and two small girls in matching sweaters trying to bail with a bait bucket. What to do? This was a shocker. Go for help? Sprint to the outlet mall and call 911 from Knife World? There was no time. The canoe was sinking before his eyes. The girls would be drowned before he reached Route 8. Could one swim to the snag? Certainly one could not. No one ever had. Was he a good swimmer? He was mediocre at best. Therefore, he would have to run for help. But running was futile. because there was no time. He had just decided that. And swimming was out of the question. Therefore, the girls would die. They were basically dead. Although that couldn't be. That was too sad. What would become of the mother who this morning had dressed them in matching sweaters? How would she cope? Soon her girls would be nude and bruised and dead on a table. It was unthinkable. He thought of Robert nude and bruised and dead on a table. What to do? He fiercely wished himself elsewhere. The girls saw him now and with their hands appeared to be trying to explain that they would be dead soon. My God, did they think he was blind? Did they think he was stupid? Was he their father? Did they think he was Christ? They were dead. They were frantic, calling out to him, but they were dead as the ancient dead, and he was alive. He was needed at home. It was a no-brainer. No one could possibly blame him for this one, and making a low sound of his despair in his throat, he kicked off his loafers and threw his long, ugly body out across the water. And now, from the books section of the January 30th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, What Monks Can Teach Us About Paying Attention, Lessons from a Centuries-Long War Against Distraction, by Casey Sepp. Who was the monkiest monk of them all? One candidate is Simeon Stylites, who lived alone atop a pillar near Aleppo for at least 35 years. Another is Macarius of Alexandria, who pursued his spiritual disciplines for 20 days straight without sleeping. He was perhaps outdone by Calupa, who never stopped praying, even when snakes filled his cave, slithering under his feet and falling from the ceiling. And then there's Pacomius, who not only managed to maintain his focus on God while living with other monks, but also ignored the demons that paraded about his room like soldiers, rattled his walls like an earthquake, and then, in a last-ditch effort to distract him, turned into scantily clad women. Not that women were only distractions. They, too, could have formidable attention spans, like the Virgin Sarah, who lived next to a river for 60 years without ever looking at it. These all-stars of attention are just a few of the monks who populate Jamie Kreiner's new book, The Wandering Mind, What Medieval Monks Tell Us About Distraction, published by Livewrite. More specifically, they are the exceptions. Most of their brethren, like most of us, were terrible at paying attention. All kinds of statistics depict our powers of concentration as depressingly withered, but as Kreiner shows, medieval monasteries were filled with people who wanted to focus on God, but couldn't. Long before televisions or TikTok, smartphones or streaming services, paying attention was already devilishly difficult. Literally so, in the case of these monks, since they associated distraction with the devil. That would be a problem if Kreiner were promising to cure anyone's screen addiction with this one medieval trick, but she's offering commiseration, not solutions. A professor at the University of Georgia, Kreiner is the author of two other books, The Social Life of Hagiography in the Merovingian Kingdom, published by Cambridge, and Legions of Pigs in the Early Medieval West, published by Yale. As those titles suggest, she is an expert on late antiquity and the early Middle Ages, but, as they might not, she's a wry and wonderful writer. In The Wandering Mind, she eschews nostalgia, rendering the past as it really was, riotously strange, yet, when it comes to the problem of attention, annoyingly familiar. As John of Dalyatha lamented back in the 8th century, all I do is eat, sleep, drink, and be negligent. That particular John started his religious life in a monastery on Cardu, one of the mountains in Turkey, where Noah's Ark was said to have landed after the flood. But Kreiner introduces us to a host of other Johns as well. John Climacus, who lived at the foot of Mount Sinai. John Cassian, who founded the Abbey of St. Victor in southern Gaul. John of Lycopolis, who lived alone in the Nitrian desert. And John Moskos, an ascetic fanboy of sorts who traveled the Mediterranean, surveying the lifestyles of the celibate and destitute. Almost all of Kreiner's subjects are Christian, but, as her Johns alone suggest, they were a cosmopolitan bunch. Her monks hail from Turfan and Toledo and everywhere in between, talking with their Muslim and Zoroastrian and Jewish and Manichaean neighbors and revealing connections to their Buddhist and Taoist contemporaries. Kreiner uses the word monk inclusively, referring to both men and women, regardless of the form of monasticism that they practiced. During the period covered by the Wandering Mind, the 4th through the 9th centuries, monastic orders were still taking shape, their leaders devising and revising rules about sleep, food, work, possessions, and prayer. All these habits of being were an attempt to get closer to God, not least by stripping away worldly distraction. But how best to do so was a matter of constant experiment and debate. Routines and schedules circulated like gossip, with everyone wondering if some other order had arrived at a superior solution to the problem of focus, or yearning to know exactly how the Apostle Paul or the Virgin Mary had arranged their days. One open question was whether monks needed to leave the world to avoid being distracted by it. Not all of them did so. Some lived as ascetics in whatever household they found themselves. Macrina, a 4th century Cappadocian woman, never moved away from her family, refusing to marry and dedicating her life to God. Similarly, not all monks gave up their belongings, since some monasteries allowed them to retain property, including slaves. Even monks who did divest themselves of worldly possessions were sometimes slow to do so. First, settling complex tax bills or figuring out how to provide for children or elderly family members. Still, in the centuries that Kreiner studies, Christians donated a full third of all the land within Western Europe, more than 100 million acres, to monasteries and churches. The monks, who surrendered their property or never had any to begin with, could choose among several forms of ascetic living. Gyrovagues lived as wanderers, begging for food and whatever else they needed. Stylites, like Simeon, lived on the top of pillars for long periods, while other monastics hunkered down in caves or hunkered up on crags. Household and itinerant monks were probably far more common than the monks we tend to picture, the so-called eremitic monks who lived alone, often in remote places, and the cenobitic monks who lived in intentional communities. That historically blind spot is partly the result of our wealth of information about monasteries, many of which maintained elaborate rule books and records that still survive. Such documents reveal widely varying strategy for staying focused on a godly life. Some monasteries screened the mail or prohibited packages. Many discouraged visitors. But others welcomed anyone at all, especially pilgrims and donors. Theories about the virtues or evils of outsiders were reflected even in the locations of religious communities. Gertrude of northern Gaul built her monastery in the desolate swamps of the Scarpe River, but Caesar al-Banat was built near the busy road between Antioch and Aleppo, so that travelers could find shelter or worship. Plenty of monastics worried that caring for such people could lead to earthly entanglements. Even the sacraments were at times seen as suspicious, with leaders discouraging their followers from performing baptisms because they might create ongoing obligations to the baptized. So extreme was some monks' commitment to foregoing human interaction that they became known for their downcast faces, avoiding eye contact whenever they left their monasteries. Even the most solitary monks, those who withdrew from both secular society and religious community, soon learned that the world had a way of finding them. Frange, a monk who lived in Egypt during the rule of the Umayyads, moved into a Pharaonic tomb to get away from it all. But even without WhatsApp or DoorDash, he remained in touch with scores of people, whether to offer a blessing or to arrange a delivery of cardamom. Archaeologists working in his tomb discovered ostraca, shards of pottery repurposed as writing slates, only some of which show him wanting to be left alone. In most of them, he is writing intercessory prayers for children or pestering his sister to bring him clothes and food. As with all who try to devote themselves to ultimate concerns, Frange's resolve was tested by his physical needs. A body isn't like a town or a monastery. You can't move out of it to reduce your worldly distractions. The best hope was to fully transform it, as 1/4th century Syriac poet said of monks, quote, "Their bodies are temples of the spirit, their minds are churches, their prayer is pure incense, and their tears are fragrant smoke." In pursuit of that kind of transformation, monastic communities zealously regulated everything about the body, from the length of facial hair to footwear. What form mortification should take, though, wasn't clear. And the attempt to free the self of all its needs except the need for God can today look like masochism or mayhem. Take bathing, which Romans adored, but which Christians came to regard warily. Some monasteries allowed regular baths, but others restricted them to periods of illness or certain times in the liturgical year, like before Christmas or Easter. A few discouraged them entirely. "I am 60 years of age," the desert mother Sylvania once boasted, "and apart from the tips of my hands, neither my feet nor my face nor any one of my limbs ever touched water." Sleeping with anyone was always a no-no, but that prohibition was straightforward compared with the labyrinthine regulations on sleeping in general. To pray without ceasing, as St. Paul encouraged the Thessalonians, was sometimes taken as an actual imperative, while other monks acknowledged the necessity of sleep, but sought to limit its allure and duration. St. Augustine argued that rich converts should be given plush bedding until they adjusted to monastic life, to deter them from quitting. But at St. John Stoudios in Constantinople, every novice, regardless of class, got the same bedding, 2 wool blankets and 2 mats, one made of straw and the other of goat hair. The monks at Amida in Mesopotamia had no beds at all, only reclining seats, wall straps, and ceiling ropes for suspending themselves by their armpits. The monks at Cartamon, near the border between Syria and Turkey, had it worse. Some of them slept standing up in closet-like cells. Eating was contentious too, not to mention competitive. Fasting was said to focus the mind. But since simply starving to death was not an option, monastic leaders imposed drastic rules on the consumption of food. Monasteries restricted the use of condiments to make sure that all monks ate the same thing, or prohibited monks from looking at one another while eating, so that they couldn't argue about portions. When Lupicinus of Condat thought that his brethren were luxuriating too much in their meals, he dumped everything into one pot and offered them the resulting mush. 12 monks were so miffed that they quit. Hagiographies like Jerome's Life of Hilarion often resembled ancient Grub Street diets, recording every last detail of people's eating habits. Antony was said to have consumed just one meal a day, bread and salt. Joseph of Bethcoqua lived off raw foods, while George of Sinai survived on capers, so bitter they could kill a camel. By contrast, some Egyptian monasteries left culinary remnants as rich and varied as King Tut's tomb. Jujubes, fenugreek, figs, grapes, pomegranates, fava beans. And the kitchen at the Benedictine Monastery of San Vincenzo Albuturno could have earned a Michelin star, given its use of elderberries, grapes, and walnuts, alongside mollusks, fish, pork, and poultry. Such abundance isn't evidence of hypocrisy. It's evidence of another dispute about how best to focus on God. Every monastery organized its days around prayer and religious reading. But some holy men argued that physical work should be avoided to recover the dignity of Adam and Eve, while others believed that it could help them glorify God. Manual labor shored up monasteries' finances and independence, and it could sharpen the mind, too. These centers of worship became centers of agriculture or industry, distinguished as they are today for their crops or crafts. Monks who focused as much on growing things as on knowing things aspired to be paragons of self-sufficiency and sustainability, making their own robes, filling their own pantries, and constructing their own furniture, not to mention writing their own books. Although books are rarely associated with distraction today, desperate as we are to escape our screens, they were objects of concern in early monastic circles. Diversions that might need to be regulated as carefully as sexual urges. Monks hemmed and hawed about when and where and for how long it was appropriate to read. In the 4th century, Evagrius Ponticus, himself an avid reader, described a common scene in the monasteries where he lived in Jerusalem and the Nile Delta. A monk who was supposed to be reading, quote, yawns a lot and readily drifts off into sleep. He rubs his eyes and stretches his arms, turning his eyes away from the book. He stares at the wall and again goes back to read for a while. Leafing through the pages, he looks curiously for the end of texts. He counts the folios and calculates the number of gatherings, finds fault with the writing and the ornamentation. Later, he closes the book and puts it under his head and falls asleep. End quote. Evagrius had a name for this inability to focus, acedia, and scholars now variously define it as depression, the so-called noonday demon, or spiritual ennui, a kind of sloth. Acedia wasn't caused by books exactly, since a monk could suffer from it even without reading. But the book was initially as suspect a technology as a smartphone is today. Evagrius argued that demons were cold, so they drew close to monks for warmth, touching their eyes and making them drowsy, especially while they were reading. The Sayings of the Desert Elders, a 5th century compilation of monastic wisdom, went further, complaining that books led to their contents being taken for granted. Quote, the prophets compiled the scriptures, and the fathers copied them, and their successors learned to repeat them by heart. Then this generation came and placed them in cupboards as useless things. Nostalgia, like narcissism, can arise from small differences. Compared with a monk like Jonas of Thamutians, a man so devout that he refused a bed, rested on a stool in the dark while reciting scripture, and had to be buried in that position because his body wouldn't straighten. Monks who just sat around reading could seem hardly worthy of the title. But monasteries largely got over such concerns and became repositories of books. Slowly, of course, since their scribes copied every volume by hand. Wearmouth Gerow, where the venerable Bede spent his life, had just 200 or so books, yet it was the largest library in England. Earlier aesthetics had given up everything, including their copies of the Gospels. But their successors came to believe that books could be objects and even sources of focus. Giving up everything isn't possible, of course. Everybody has a brain, and the brain is the greatest distraction technology of all. Half of The Wandering Mind is about how monks tried to maintain focus in the face of the world, their communities, their bodies, and their books. But the other half is about what they thought about thinking. Kreiner is fascinating on the ways monks attempted to manipulate their memories and remake their minds, and on the urgency they brought to those tasks, knowing the dangers that lurked even if they eliminated all physical temptations. A monk singing in church could be reveling in the memory of a delicious meal, while another, praying in her cell, might mistake the wanderings of her own mind for divine revelation. Kreiner compares the minds of medieval monastics to construction sites, describing the machinery they employed, quote, to reorganize their past thoughts, draw themselves deeper into present thoughts, and establish new cognitive patterns for the future, end quote. Some of this is World Memory Championships territory, with monks using mnemonic devices and multi-sensory prompts to stuff their brains with biblical texts and holy meditations. Today, we think mostly of memory palaces, but many medieval monks turned to images of trees or ladders to create elaborate visualizations, meant not only to encode good knowledge, but also to override bad impulses and sinful memories. Other imagery flourished too. By the 12th century, the six-winged angel described by the prophet Isaiah doubled as what Kreiner calls an, quote, organizational avatar, end quote, with monks inscribing holy subtopics on each wing and feather. While other monks filled an imaginary Noah's Ark, tuzi-tuzi, with sacred history and theology. Whether monks built arks, angels, or palaces, vigilance was expected of them all, and metacognition was one of their most critical duties, necessary for determining whether any given thought served God or the devil. For the truly devout, there was no such thing as overthinking it. Discernment required constantly monitoring one's mental activity and interrogating the source of any distraction. Some monasteries encouraged monks to use checklists for reviewing their thoughts throughout the day, and one of the desert fathers was said to keep two baskets for tracking his own. He put a stone in one basket whenever he had a virtuous thought, and a stone in the other whenever he had a sinful thought. Whether he ate dinner depended on which basket had more stones by the end of the day. Such careful study of the mind yielded gorgeous writing about it, and Kreiner collects centuries worth of metaphors for concentration. Fish swimming peaceably in the depths, helmsmen steering a ship through storms, potters perfecting their ware, hens sitting atop their eggs, and just as many metaphors for distracting, mice taking over your home, flies swarming your face, hair poking you in the eyes, horses breaking out of your barn. These earthy analog metaphors, though, betray the centuries between us and the monks who wrote them. For all that, the wandering mind helps to collapse the differences between their world and ours. It also illuminates one very profound distinction. We inherited the monkish obsession with attention, and even inherited their moral judgments about the capacity or failure to concentrate. But most of us did not inherit their clarity about what is worthy of our concentration. Medieval monks shared a common cosmology that depended on their attention. Justinian the Great claimed that if monks lived holy lives, they could bring God's favor upon the whole of the Byzantine Empire, and the prayers of Simeon Stylites were said to be like support beams holding up all of creation. Kreiner writes that, quote, distraction was not just a personal problem, they knew. It was part of the warp of the world. Attention would not have been morally necessary, would not have been the objective of their culture of conflict and control, were it not for the fact that it centered on the divine order, end quote. Perhaps that is why so many of us have half-done tasks on our to-do lists and half-read books on our bedside tables, scroll through Instagram while simultaneously semi-watching Netflix, and swipe between apps and tabs endlessly from when we first open our eyes until we finally fall asleep. One uncomfortable explanation for why so many aspects of modern life corrode our attention is that they do not merit it. The problem for those of us who don't live in monasteries but hope to make good use of our days is figuring out what might. That is the real contribution of the wandering mind. It moves beyond the question of why the mind wanders to the more difficult, more beautiful question of where it should rest. And now from the January 27th, 2023 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, what is woke? What exactly does woke mean, and how did it become so powerful? A conversation with David Remnick and others. David, for years, many on the right have been lambasting a certain kind of progressive sensibility. Think about the ubiquity of political correctness in the 1990s. Endless fodder for Rush Limbaugh and talk radio. The furor over PC was nothing compared to the political battle over woke. In Washington, in the House of Representatives, there's talk of forming an anti-woke caucus. For conservatives now, wokeness is the root cause of everything negative, from lower military recruitment to deadly mass shootings. As one senator insisted after the shooting in Uvalde, Texas, what does woke actually mean? To get a deeper insight on how such an ambiguous term became so powerful in this country and well beyond, I spoke with Tony Thorne. He's a linguist and a lexicographer based in the UK, and he wrote the Dictionary of Contemporary Slang. Slang is definitely his thing. Tony, when did you start hearing or becoming aware of the word that is now ubiquitous, woke? Tony Thorne. I came across woke, I think at the time of Black Lives Matter, when that movement and that phenomenon started to trend, so probably around 2014. The word, of course, has been around for much longer, but that's when it started trending on social media and in discussions of politics and culture. David. My understanding of the word is that it's been around for a very long time, particularly in the black community, particularly in the United States. Tony Thorne. It actually probably goes right back to the 19th century, because woke, it's a non-standard, therefore not really correct form of the verb to wake or waken. It's a non-standard past participle, so instead of saying I was woken up or I was awakened, not just black people or people of color, but also, I think, southern white speakers in the southern states of the U.S. would have said this, I got woke, I was woke. It's a dialect, it's an informal dialect, but it was very much part of the African-American vernacular English. Well, when does it take on its political sense of awareness? I think in conversation it probably happened in the 1960s, but the earliest record we can find of it, I think, was in 1971. There was a play produced in the U.S. by someone called Barry Beckham called Garvey Lives, of talking about Marcus Garvey, that black liberationist. In this play, they repeated the phrase, Mr. Garvey says, I must stay woke, I must be woke. That was 1971. The word still didn't become common, wasn't used by many people publicly, I think, until 2008. When a singer produced the song called Master Teacher, part of that song, chorus, used the word stay woke, I must stay woke, or you must stay woke. It was 2008 that it transferred into popular culture, I think, in the U.S., not in the U.K. We didn't hear about it until Black Lives Matter popularized. The references to woke before 2016, 17, 18 were straightforward. It means socially aware, it means empathetic. Afterwards, the definitions changed to it means self-righteous, it means pretending to be socially aware. The term had already become twisted, if you like, became difficult to use. Then the right, the conservative right, seizes hold of this word in order to jeer at what they see as the self-righteous left. David, now when I pick up the right-wing press, I see Fox News. I see the Daily Mail in Britain. Woke is the center of the right-wing platform, not any particular fiscal policy. When I hear Ron DeSantis, it's all about we are the center of the anti-woke movement. That's what the rhetoric of the campaign is, because it seems to connect more easily than complicated policy prescriptions about foreign policy or domestic policy. Am I right? Tony Thorne, I think you're absolutely right. Linguistically, I think woke is a very interesting term right now because I think that it's an unusable word, although it's used all the time, because it doesn't actually mean anything. Rather, like I think in the U.S., Antifa has come, but perhaps it did mean something. Perhaps it did describe an actual grouping, but it's come to be a shorthand for everybody we disagree with, and I think woke has become a lazy slur. Are we fighting about language more than we did before? Tony Thorne, yes, what has happened to public language, public discourse, the language used in the media, at least, and on social media, which is the new phenomenon, what I think has happened in the last decades is this. If you want even perhaps your opponents in the media to reproduce your message, you need to cultivate them and you need to join in with them in the messaging procedure. Bill Clinton, then emulated by Tony Blair, picked up spin and the notion of the spin doctors. But then what happened is this same process evolved and became more and more, if you like, divisive, so that then you have Steve Bannon advising Donald Trump. Only now it's different. It's not spin anymore. It's something far more aggressive. Bannon himself used terms like fire hosing, like flooding the zone. What he meant by that was overwhelming your opponents with a barrage of messages using very strong language, not simply to counter their arguments. It wasn't about just putting your own spin, your own bias on some piece of news. It was about destroying their credibility, denigrating them, and overwhelming them so that your opponents became unable to express themselves or even unable to understand the public discourse. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.